The new issue of the interdisciplinary journal Social Research explores how the way we write and the meaning of writing are rapidly changing. It asks how artificial intelligence transforms norms and expectations that for centuries associated writing with voice, originality, and agency. If writing is a technology that restructures thought, as philosopher Walter Ong put it, then which written forms of thought and reflection will survive AI, or conversely, will be enabled by it? What new literacies are required? How will new technologies rework the relationship between writing and the marketplace? In 9 groundbreaking articles, the summer 2026 issue of the journal tackles these and other questions that pertain to the issue's title, Writing in the 21st Century. Social Research is the flagship journal of the New School for Social Research in New York City. You can find the journal on Project Muse or at www.socres.org. That is www.socres.org.
That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the now.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison, and we are very excited to welcome to the podcast today my old friend. We did time in Cornell together, beautiful Ithaca, New York, and that is Jake Nabel. Jake is a Tom
Hard Burst, time in Cornell.
Hard time at Cornell. Like, very hard time. You joke, but... But it was. Tom Brose, early career professor of classical studies and assistant professor of classics and ancient Mediterranean studies at Penn State. That is Jake's title. And he's also the author of the recently released The Arsacids of Rome, Misunderstanding in Roman-Parthian Relations. Jake, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. And yeah, a real pleasure to have the chance now, especially to talk about Iran's deep and rich history.
And not to talk about the war so much. We'll get to it, but...
Yeah, not to talk about the war, at least not at the beginning.
Yeah.
But Jake, okay, so you might be shocked to learn that people might not be very familiar with what was going on in antiquity at the turn of the, what do you call it? So maybe before we even get into the book, you could like set the scene of the Mediterranean world. Like, who are the major powers? What are the major interactions happening here? What do we know? What don't we know? And then even after that, I'd love to situate your book in sort of this new turn to essentially examining non only Latin and Greek sources, but different types of sources and how that's expanding our view of the ancient Mediterranean world very broadly defined. So there's a lot there, but I think we'll need to do some stage setting, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely. So the book is set in the first centuries BCE and CE, and there are basically, in the ancient Mediterranean and Near East, two great imperial powers of the time. One is the Roman Empire, which is a very well-studied empire, certainly in the Western Academy, not least because it serves as a kind of paradigm or a proto-empire for the European empires in the 19th century. But the other empire, the Parthian Empire on the Iranian plateau, is much less studied, and its history has been quite poorly understood until recently. The kind of basic scene setting there is that the first, what's sometimes called the first global empire of antiquity, is also centered on the Iranian plateau. This is the Achaemenid Persian Empire. They rule a massive territory that stretches from Egypt to Central Asia. They're around for about 200 years or so, 550 to 330 BCE. But in the end, they're conquered by Alexander the Great in a very swift and devastating campaign of conquest. Alexander dies very quickly without any real plan for his succession, and his empire is immediately carved up by his generals. The one who gets Central Asia, the Iranian plateau, Mesopotamia, and parts of Asia Minor, his name is Seleucus, and Seleucus is a Macedonian general. He speaks Greek, but now he rules all of these territories outside of his original homeland, and the dynasty that he founds will rule in those places for many, many decades, about 150 years in most of those places. Now, around 248 BCE, the Seleucid Empire deals with a rebellion. So this is a rebellion that arises in northeastern Iran, so roughly like northeastern Iran and modern Turkmenistan. The new rebellion is led by a figure named Arsaces, who founds an empire that is ruled by the Arsacid dynasty, which takes its name from him. And the ethnic group, which is the ruling class of that empire, is called the Parthians. They conquer the Iranian plateau. They conquer Mesopotamia. They drive the Seleucids out of these territories. And in a way, this is a sort of Iranian reconquista of this territory because the Parthians are the speakers of a Middle Iranian language. However, the empire has really been something of a riddle because it's very hard to fit into our grand narratives of the ancient past. So is this kind of like a weird coda to the Hellenistic period? There's a case to be made for that because the Arsacids, their early coinage, for instance, they use Greek. They take a lot of the elements of their royal iconography from Hellenistic kingship, and they're very much a product of the world that Alexander the Great leaves behind. Are they an Iranian reconquest of this period, the kind of resumption of Iranian rule after this weird caesura when you have the Hellenistic powers coming in and then eventually driven out? Are they simply a prelude to the Sasanian Empire? And the Sasanians are important because they are the first empire in late antiquity to use Iranian as a toponym and as the reference to the ruling class of the empire. You know, where do the Arsacids fit in? How exactly should we situate them in our grand understanding of the period? These are all open questions because it's been such a little studied empire. But in any event, they are pretty clearly the imperial antagonist of the Roman Empire. They defeat the Romans in a very grand battle in 53 BCE, the Battle of Carrhae, one of the worst defeats that the Roman Empire ever suffered on the battlefield. And then there is kind of a rough demarcation along the Euphrates River for another couple of centuries. And that's the world that I'm writing about in the book.
That's really helpful.
So to get sort of into the other part of Danny's question, but more generally, the challenge, one of the challenges with understanding the Parthians is like they don't leave sources, right? I mean, like ancient Iran, ancient Persia is not replete with extant historical sources in general, which is why, you know, for a long time when people wanted to study the Achaemenids, they read Herodotus, which obviously has huge problems in terms of like, you know, who are you really getting your information from? And for the Parthians, the same thing exists, right? It's maybe worse, I think, for the Parthians. Always struck me as like even more of a black hole in terms of, you know, any kind of sources that come out of that empire compared to even the Sasanians or the Achaemenids. And so you're relying on the Romans, like on Roman historians, which again, like, you know, where are you getting your information from? So can you talk a little bit about the challenge of understanding this empire and what you did in the book, which I think is very interesting, to try and come up with a body of source material that can at least surround a Parthian, you know, kind of history or Parthian sense of what they're doing without relying on the Romans.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly as you say, reliance on Greco-Roman historiography. I mean, that's the main source base for political history. And this is a book about political history. And yes, using the testimonies of the Romans, who were variously misinformed about the Parthians or hostile to the Parthians or both, that's obviously a major methodological problem. And this has been very pronounced in the study of the empire because its disciplinary configuration has always been something of a mystery. It's usually kind of annexed to the field of classics, which is based on Greek and Roman texts. And so those perspectives have really dominated. What I tried to do in the book is to, yeah, establish a method for reconstructing Parthian political history on the basis of sources from the territories that the Parthians themselves actually rule over. You are right, Derek, of course, that there are relatively few textual sources from the heyday of the Parthians in Iran. There aren't none, however. We have some epigraphic evidence, so writings on stone in Greek, we have some in Aramaic, and then from the later Parthian period, we have some in the Parthian language, a Middle Iranian language. So that's the most important kind of data set for me. Wherever possible, I try to begin with those sources. The other intervention that I make is to draw on late antique evidence that's mostly a product of the Sasanian world. And the background there is that in 224 CE, the Arsacids are overthrown in Iran by the Sasanian dynasty. And this is the last great empire of pre-Islamic Iranian history. They'll be around from 224 CE to 651 CE. Evidence is relatively abundant from the Sasanian Empire. So we have epigraphy, we have literature in Middle Persian, which was the language of the Sasanians. Most of it is religious in nature from Zoroastrianism, which is the great religion of pre-Islamic Iran, but not all of it. And even those sources are of considerable use. And then on the other end of the empire, we have a very important data set for the book. We do have a historiographical corpus of sources in Armenian. So in late antique Armenia, this new historiography tradition pops up, which really stands outside of the classical tradition in Greek and in Latin. And in fact, the Armenian historians are really writing much more in an Iranian milieu than they are in a Roman one. So those are the sources that I use in the book to try to make the case that, as you know, the book is about these princes, we can call them, to use a relatively neutral term, who go from the Parthian Empire and live at the court of the Roman emperor in the West. And what I try to do is establish a way of seeing them from the Parthian point of view. The Romans call them hostages because the Romans are thumping their chests and predictably, issue a series of rather jingoistic statements about what it means for these princes to be showing up in the Roman Empire. But what I try to argue is that from the Parthian point of view, an institution we can reconstruct on the basis of Iranian evidence is instead fosterage, so simply the ruling of a child by non-natal parents. And from the Iranian point of view, this looks really, really different and in fact has totally different implications for the underlying power relationship.
That institution you can trace back prior to the Parthians, right? Like you can get that from, and that interpretation of what's going on from, Aramaic sources in the ancient Mesopotamia, from Egypt, from the way that the Bronze Age, let's say more or less societies functioned, right? Right. So there's some use of that corpus of material as well. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And some of that is comparative rather than, necessarily making the case that, the Assyrian Empire is necessarily making a direct impact on the Parthians, although it is certainly true that it is upstream from the Parthian world, if by some distance. So some of it is comparative. Some of it probably makes an influence on the Parthian world. But, our very earliest sources for interstate relations don't really have to do with the Greeks and Romans. They come from much older ancient Near Eastern societies, correspondence among the great kings of the Eastern Mediterranean interstate system. And yeah, I do try to draw on that evidence as well, because before the Romans come along and in the Eastern Mediterranean, interstate relations are really about kinships that cross all these political boundaries. It's a matter of brotherhood. It's a matter of intermarriage. And it's a matter of the ruling families of different empires being connected in all of these distinct ways by kinship mechanisms. So for me, the Parthians, when they send their kids to the Romans, this is what they're doing. They are opening up a kind of kinship networking with the family that rules Rome, the dynasty of the Julio-Claudians. The Romans don't understand it in that way because the Roman background is very different, but this is the world that the Parthians are stepping into.
Yeah, I think it's important to talk about that background. So what is the cultural misunderstanding here? How would the Romans not only approach clientel fosterage, but the way they view marriage? And where does this notion of clientel fosterage come from? And so there's this big cultural divide that you're trying to bridge the gap over, millennia. But let's talk a little bit about both of those.
Sure, yeah. Well, we can maybe start with the Roman side where the situation is already complicated enough, but then we can get to the Near East. So the Roman frame of reference is the institution of hostageship. Rome, during its course of imperial growth, conquers many territories all around the Mediterranean. And a common corollary of conquest was the taking of hostages from these foreign communities. They did it in the West with various tribal groups in Spain and in Gaul, for instance. They did it in the East, where there were big established empires that Rome conquered and subdued. And so the way this usually worked was that a relatively young person, the age kind of varies a bit, but it could be someone in childhood, it could be somebody in early adolescence or even late adolescence, they would go to Rome and live in the city of Rome, and the Romans would call them hostages, you know, people who remained in the city. That, of course, conjures up for us the impression that Rome had like a dagger to their throat and they're waiting to execute them the minute their communities step out of line. This, in fact, very rarely happens. The form of domination was really much more about symbolic domination rather than, you know, actual human collateral. So it basically never happens that Rome executes these people when their communities step out of line. But the point is, they are in Rome and they are there for the populace of Rome to see because they furnish a symbol of Roman domination of those communities. On the Parthian side, the story is really different. And what I try to show is that the Parthians have a tradition of fosterage, and this simply means sending a child from the family of the King of Kings. So the very most powerful kinship group that rules and presides over the entire empire, they send those children out to usually aristocratic families who were important in their own right and powerful in their own right, but still in a position of clientage, in a position of subordination and deference relative to the King of Kings. And anthropologists call this cliental fosterage when the people who do the raising are in a subordinate position relative to the kid that they get, who then grows up in their household. And this, I argue, leads to a situation of misunderstanding, because the Parthians have this one social institution, cliental fosterage, and for them, that's the situation when you send out a royal child. The Romans have their own institution, hostageship. That's when you get a royal child. And because these two empires are extremely far apart geographically, you know, and geography, remember, matters a whole lot more in the ancient world than it does in the modern one, because these are manifestly two cultures which do not understand each other well. This huge gulf in understanding opens up between the way the Parthians see it and the way the Romans see it. The Romans say, hey, we're getting hostages. Parthia has accepted Roman superiority. And then the Parthians are saying, we're giving clientel fosterage kids to the Romans. Rome's accepted Parthian superiority. So unexpectedly and fortuitously, both sides are able to walk away from this, convinced of their supremacy and convinced of their dominance over the other. And the thing that really keeps the balance is simply a huge misunderstanding and the unexpected divergence between the cultural frameworks on either side.
It might also be talking about, why are the Parthians sending children? They're not necessarily in a subordinate position to Rome, or are they? What are they doing there? So there's this misunderstanding fundamentally about what they are doing. But what is the, if we're trying to center the Parthians in this narrative, what are they doing in their perspective?
The most important thing is that this is simply for them an assertion of dominance. If you send one of your princes to a foreign ruler, that's a clientel institution, that foreign ruler has now been subordinated to your empire. So the Arsacids and the Parthians they rule now have a reasonable basis for claiming that the Parthian Empire has subordinated Rome to its own imperial majesty. So that's simply one part of the equation, is simply that this is an assertion of supremacy. Now, after that, there are all kinds of, you know, contingent objectives that you can use as an Arsacid king if you're interested in making use of this kind of kinship working mechanism. Dynastic politics are a very brutal and competitive realm. You may, for instance, kind of suspect that one of your children is plotting to supplant you if you're the reigning king. This kind of thing happens all the time in dynastic politics. Princes are used either by, you know, seditious plotters in an attempt to overthrow the reigning king, or the princes will launch the coup attempt on their own. If you suspect them of this kind of initiative, well, you can kind of kill two birds with one stone. You can assert dominance over Rome and then remove that potentially seditious prince from the realm of domestic politics by getting them out of the way. You send them to another empire. You've kind of neutralized the danger that they may pose. You can also do the same thing, but in reverse. If you want to protect a kid, and in fact, in one case, this is pretty clearly what happened. We had a situation where there are sort of rival groups. So the various factions headed by the sons of a particular king, they were sort of maneuvering against one another, and there seemed to be a very real possibility that one of the princes was going to try to assassinate another prince. If you, the king, are worried about the kid who could be a victim in that kind of circumstance, well, send them out of the way and protect them. You can also protect them from the dangers of dynastic politics by removing them from the scene and sending them to the relatively safe setting of Rome. So the overarching framework is simply establishing dominance and, you know, maintaining a claim of superiority to the Roman Empire. But then under that heading, there are all kinds of, you know, contingent objectives that an Arsacid king can pursue by picking and choosing which one of his sons or sometimes many of the sons at once will go abroad. There's all kinds of reasons that a king may decide to pick one prince rather than another to ship them away.
So let's talk, because the other side of the question is, of course, how they are treated at Rome. So Rome is viewing these princes in a very different way than the Parthians are viewing them. So what do we know about their treatment? How are they used socially within Rome? It's kind of funny. You have these two empires who both think that they're subordinating the other because they have this strange social institution that is misunderstood on both sides. So it actually, ironically, it seems to have led to some comedy between the two imperial powers. Is that accurate? And what are they? What's actually the lives of these kids like in Rome? Not necessarily kids, but teens and kids.
Yeah, it's a great question. And the answer is, it's kind of, there are a couple of things going on. From the point of view of the Roman central authorities, the most important function that these princes mostly have is that they are exhibited to the Roman population as the sort of prizes of imperial conquest, as a sign that Rome has subordinated the Parthian Empire, which of course is the exact opposite of what the Parthians think is going on. So, for instance, there are these kind of carefully choreographed and stage-managed imperial spectacles. Augustus, for instance, the first emperor of Rome, trots the children who arrive during his emperorship. He leads them through the arena when he holds a public spectacle with, you know, gladiatorial combat and athletic competitions and stuff, when huge crowds gather. He leads them through the middle of the arena and then sits them above him in a position just behind him, which is something that signifies social deference. The kind of less important you are, the higher up you have to sit. So he sits them behind him in the second row at one of his spectacles, and he makes sure that the entire Roman audience sees these people by making them take what is only, you know, what could only be imagined as like the most ostentatious possible path to their seats. The Emperor Caligula holds this very grandiose spectacle, which is kind of a quasi-Roman triumph. The triumph is a peculiar Roman institution. It is basically a military parade of conquest. Normally, they were held at Rome, and you kind of follow a careful route, and you make all the prisoners of war and all the plunder that you've taken in war, all the hostages you've taken, if you've taken hostages, you make them all, you know, walk in procession so that the gathered crowds can see them and understand that this means that Rome has dominated the territory where all these people are coming from. So Caligula makes them proceed in a procession like this. He uses one of the recent arrivals of his period to, you know, basically furnish a symbol of human plunder from the Parthian Empire. And then at the end of the Julio-Claudian period, Nero does a very similar thing as well, trots them out, makes sure that a huge Roman crowd sees them. And the conclusion that they're supposed to draw is, this is an assertion of Roman supremacy over the Parthian Empire. So that's their main function from the emperor's point of view. That's the main leverage that he wants to get out of them. What are their actual lives like? You know, once the big spectacles were done, they lived quite comfortable lives. I mean, they were housed at public expense. We're told this very clearly by our sources. So the Roman people pay for them to live in a very nice aristocratic house in Rome. They live very comfortably. There were quite a lot of them at a certain point, probably, you know, one or two dozen is something like what we're talking about, though we don't have precise numbers. So it's not clear whether they all lived in the same place or not, but certainly they lived very comfortably in Rome. They seemed to go out to the countryside for hunting expeditions, which is a very common thing for Roman aristocrats to do. And they're kind of prisoners, but in a gilded cage, if that makes sense. They're housed quite comfortably and in a manner that is fitting of their royal dignity. So they're not kept locked up in a dungeon and made to eat crusts of bread or anything like that. They're treated quite well, but they're also subjected to these probably quite humiliating spectacles. What that actually was like, this very ambivalent kind of treatment that they received, and how they themselves perceived their role and how they must have negotiated between the Parthian understanding, which is that they were quite important dignitaries, which sometimes was true in Rome because they were treated like that, but then sometimes they were treated in a rather degrading way. You know, this must have been quite a lot for them to process, and they, better than anyone else, would have been well positioned to negotiate between these two variable understandings. But whether they actually are the cause of any breakthrough in understanding is quite unlikely, because aside from their good treatment, they don't seem to have been, you know, especially influential, at least in Rome.
Did they ever have children with any of the local Romans? Do we know about that?
They don't. And sorry, yeah, thank you for the follow-up, because that's another important thing, which touches on a question you raised a moment ago. Yeah, I mean, from the Roman point of view, from the Parthian point of view, what you might expect if you're interested in kinship networking with a foreign dynasty is just use the institution of intermarriage. That's a very common way of establishing dynastic alliances in all sorts of ancient settings, from the Mediterranean, from the Near East, and other parts of the pre-modern world as well. So why not just do that? And the answer, really, the fault for this has to be laid at the feet of the Romans. The Romans are very endogamous in their marital tendencies. Throughout the Republic, the game of marital power politics is really only played among a very limited set of Italian families. It grows a little bit. You know, certain families in Italy from outside of Rome are eventually kind of given a seat at the table, but absolutely not will high-born Roman aristocratic women be marrying, you know, what the Romans call barbarians from this Eastern exotic world, of which they are variously contemptuous and or terrified. So this is really culturally kind of out of the question. And then Augustus comes along, the imperial phase of Roman history begins, and Augustus is notoriously someone who kind of tries to legislate the sexual morality of the Roman ruling classes. Those are ruling classes that have been exhausted by civil war, by the civil wars that take place between, well, a host of combatants over the last couple generations of the Roman Republic. The senatorial class gets really wiped out and decimated, and Augustus really tries to build it back up. And by doing so, one of his measures that he tried to use was creating a kind of set of purity laws and laws governing things like chastity and senatorial procreation. So it's really a non-starter. You know, the Romans are not going to intermarry with these figures, certainly not Roman aristocratic women marrying these princes, and even the other way around would be quite strange and anomalous from the Roman point of view. So marriage is just a non-starter. That's part of the reason why I think fosterage, this other kind of sort of kinship networking mechanism, where these children become the foster kids, basically, of the Roman emperor, that steps into the void because marriage just isn't going to work because of the Romans. I think the Parthians would have been perfectly happy to do it, but the Romans were not, and that's why they resort to fosterage instead.
I think the use of these princes or these children in triumph ceremonies is interesting, and it maybe raises the question of, like, can we answer what position Parthia occupied in the Roman mind, if that's the right way to put it? Like, when you talk about what an emperor, what a Roman ruler would want to portray to the crowd in Rome, about the Parthians, it's seems somewhat divorced from the actual reality of the Roman-Parthian interactions in the East, which never went anywhere. Like every time there was war, the Romans either lost or there was, I mean, I guess whoever was the aggressor seems to have lost every time, you know, they went to war with each other. So it's very ineffectual kind of, you know, activity when it's not a disaster like a Carrhae, but, you know, for the Romans, they don't really ever make any headway, it seems like, against the Parthians. So but this is at the same time, a population that comes out of, to some extent, a Greek tradition, understands Alexander, understands the wars between the Greeks and the Persians. So there probably is some sense of Persia as this great other thing that's a threat that we have to worry about, which doesn't really map onto reality. But if you're a Roman emperor, like, what are you trying to say to people about Parthia?
Yeah. That's right on. So the Achaemenids, the empire we spoke about a little while ago, the first great empire of world history and the first one centered on the Iranian plateau, what the Romans say is that Alexander's campaigns are kind of an interlude, but what the Parthians are a reborn version of the Achaemenid empire. They have stepped into the void that the Achaemenids left behind, and they've inherited their kind of political and cultural legacy. Interestingly, we know very little about the Parthian memory of the Achaemenids, whether they actually saw themselves in this way. This is one of the great riddles of pre-Islamic Iranian studies, whether first the Parthians and then later the Sasanians remembered the Achaemenids, and if so, if they saw themselves as their successors. Very controversial issue. But the Romans certainly are convinced of this. There's no question about that. And yeah, I mean, they say a set of kind of contradictory things that are always a little bit in tension with one another. And it depends which source you're looking at and at what point in time. If the emperor can claim dominance over Parthia by virtue of taking quote unquote hostages from them, he'll definitely try to do that and make the case that Rome has dominated Parthia and subordinated it to its, you know, kind of sphere of influence. But that said, one sort of sentiment that pops up very often in Roman literature is that the Parthian Empire is the one place out there in the world which is another empire of comparable size, of comparable strength, and of comparable power to Rome's own. And it is kind of a pure polity in that regard. And that sentiment is quite clear to detect in a number of Roman sources. So it's this, there's a real tension there. On the one hand, the emperors are constantly claiming to have dominated Parthia and subordinated it, but it's a little different from outright conquering it and putting troops on the ground, to use a term from modern parlance, to put troops on the ground in the Parthian Empire. They do try to do that from time to time a bit later on. So after the period that the book is concerned with, a number of emperors do try to invade Parthian territory. They have some success, but they never managed to rule the Mesopotamia, basically, modern-day Iraq. They never managed to rule that empire for a very long time. So the message is, by turns, we've conquered Parthia. We have kept Parthia at bay. You know, part of what the emperor does is they keep them on the other side of the Euphrates, and we Romans are on the West Bank, and that's the rough delimiter of the spheres of influence. And then sometimes they try to conquer it and try to make the case that it's a danger and we have to lead a massive expedition over there. All of these things are kind of going on over the course of the first couple of centuries CE, but the expressions of co-equality are kind of the most interesting thing. And, you know, if we see that in some Roman sources, I think we have to appreciate what Parthia's accomplishment was, because they really occupy a place in the Roman historical imaginary that no other foreign people really does.
And can we talk about it from the other direction? I know the material is much sparser, but from inscriptions, is there anything that we can glean about how the Parthians regarded the Romans? I mean, you know, you, as you said, it's not clear if they really harken back to the Achaemenids, but they did come out of the collapse of the Seleucid Empire, and the Romans held parts of that empire. So was there any, and I know the Parthians got involved in like the civil wars after Caesar's assassination, like, was there any, you know, sense of trying, like, what, how did they regard Rome, I guess would be my question. Do we know that?
It's much harder to establish given the evidence base, the much smaller evidence base at our disposal on the Parthian side. You know, part of what I do on the book is to make a case for what you're asking, though, Derek. Through the institution of clientele fosterage, they would have had a very reasonable case to make that Parthia had mastered Rome, had subordinated it to the Arsacid family through the institution of fosterage. But aside from that, you know, there are a couple of revealing pieces of evidence here and there. A couple of Parthian kings use the title Philoromaios on their coinage, which means lover of Romans. And that might seem like a try-hard kind of title where they're trying to appeal to a superior power. But actually, no, this is not the case, because the Parthians regularly in their coinage used the title Philhellen, so lover of Greeks. And they use this because some of the places they conquer have these very large Greek poleis, places that are being run as Greek city-states. That's a kind of holdover of the Hellenistic period. So they put Philhellen on their coins because they're presiding over those communities and they're showing their patronage over those communities. So if you see Philoromaios, lover of Romans, on a coin, this is a sign that Parthia sort of views Rome as kind of a little brother or something like this, as in an inferior position rather than in a superior one. And then once we get into the Sasanian period, then we have much more evidence for how Iranians, and it's not wrong to use the term at that point, Iranians conceive of the Roman-Iranian relationship. One very compelling image that's been in the news recently is a relief at the site of Naqsh-e-Rustam in southwestern Iran, which shows Shapur I, so that's the second king of the Sasanian Empire. He rules in the 3rd century CE. It shows him seated on horseback, looking very majestic, and in front of him are two Roman emperors, one of whom he has grasped by the hand. That's Valerian, the only Roman emperor to fall into the hands of the foreign enemy and to be taken alive as a prisoner. The Sasanians take him prisoner, and his imprisonment is shown in that relief. And the other is Philip the Arab, another 3rd century emperor. And Shapur basically shook him down for a massive indemnity payment. So once we start to get, you know, good art historical and textual evidence in the Sasanian period, it's very clear that Iranians are making claims of domination over Rome, just as the Roman sources show for Parthia in an earlier generation. So it's quite reasonable to imagine that those claims were being maintained already in Parthian times.
Might be interesting to talk about the moments or the few times where the Arsacids returned from Rome to Parthia. What are those moments and what do they suggest about the relationship here?
Yeah, it's a really interesting series of transactions. It happens multiple times. I mean, that's one intriguing dynamic of this relationship is at several points in time, members of the Parthian ruling classes, not the royal dynasty, so not the Arsacid dynasty, usually it is kind of seditious aristocrats who are not happy with the reign of the current king. They decide, hey, there's a big pool of Arsacids living in Rome. Let's go appeal to the Roman emperor. We'll go get a young prince from this foreign territory, and let's bring him back to Parthia and install him on the throne. And this happens several times. It happens over and over again. The usual treatment of this by mostly Roman historians is that, you know, this is kind of a humiliating intrusion. The Roman Empire has kind of infiltrated the realm of Parthian domestic politics, because they've kind of used a sleeper agent and triggered civil war in the Parthian Empire to kind of defuse the threat of a foreign enemy. That's not totally wrongheaded, I don't think. There is some value in that interpretation. But I try to show something different, which is that these aristocrats who are going to the Roman emperor and asking, you know, can we get one of your young princes so we can bring him back to Parthia? When they do this, they are not, in their conception, they're not appealing to a foreign power in a seditious and covert operation, because these same aristocratic families, these are the ones who, in normal times, they serve as clientele fosterage for the Arsacid family. So they view the emperor's custody of Arsacid princes as like a totally normal thing, because they themselves often do this as well. And the evidence for Iranian fosterage makes that kind of dynamic very clear. So when they go over and petition the emperor, they are not, you know, sneaking off and covertly meeting with a foreign head of state in their conception. they are appealing to a colleague, basically, somebody who is their colleague in clientele fosterage for the Arsacid dynasty. And that, I think, makes a very clear mark in our sources. Like the speeches that they make when they go in front of the Roman emperor is they're kind of appealing to him as a colleague. And, you know, as somebody who, like us, is invested in the proper management of the Arsacid family, help us out, give us one of your princes so we can take him back and try to put him on the throne. This never works out. I mean, I think in comparative perspective, this is not terribly surprising that these princes who have spent years, decades, sometimes their entire lives away from the Parthian Empire, away from their homeland, they just don't tend to work very well as kings. Several of them do go back. One of them is king for a few years. The other cases, they never really even manage to consolidate their hold on the throne to begin with. They always seem to face very serious resistance. And something that the Roman sources tell us, and here the point that we were making earlier about the Roman nature of the evidence, this is where we're really handicapped by that. But what the Roman sources say is that they go back, and then at least some Parthians are saying, these are the debased, degraded slaves of the Roman emperor. They have sunk down into a state of subjection. They've become the pets of the emperors because of their long captivity in the Roman Empire. And they are no true Parthians anymore. They are alienated from their Arsacid heritage. We've got to get rid of this guy. It's a humiliating thing to have somebody who lived in Rome for years now dominant and sitting in the throne of the King of Kings. Now, a couple questions arise there. Was such rhetoric actually, was this a real feature of Parthian political rhetoric, or is it just something that the Roman sources are saying? The Roman sources have their own reasons for, you know, passing this kind of discourse along to us. The most important historian, somebody named Tacitus, he was very critical of the early Julio-Claudian emperors, who are the foster fathers of these young Arsacids. So if they can find a stick to beat the emperors with, they're going to do it. And if they can make the case that the Parthians, you know, took one look at this Arsacid prince who had rubbed elbows with Caligula for many years and had, you know, of course, Caligula had totally ruined the moral fiber of the young man. How could we ever expect somebody to succeed in Parthian territory? Right. So the Roman sources have their own reasons to make this kind of case and to paint the transaction with this brush. However, in comparative perspective, this would not at all be a surprising thing for the Parthians to have actually said. People, especially royals who live abroad for years, decades, or whatever, they are very often vulnerable to these accusations of going native, basically, of going local and of becoming the acculturated tools of their foreign hosts. So it would not be surprising at all if the Parthians really were saying things like this. The next question is, to what degree was that kind of rhetorical case actually the reason for their downfall? Did it mobilize Parthians against them? Or is it simply the case that they just happened to lose the battles for other reasons, you know, contingent reasons that had nothing to do with acculturation? Our evidence doesn't really allow us to, you know, come down on one side or another there, I would say. But those are the issues that are on the table and that we have to keep in mind.
So I think let's talk about why this practice ended. And then I think it might be worthwhile talking about the role that this period plays in the modern Iranian imagination. I don't know, Jake, if you've heard, there's some news happening right now with Iran. So we should talk a little bit about the modern period. But why did this practice seem to end?
Yeah, good question. Complicated question. And I think the best we can do is consider sort of a number of factors. Surely one part of the answer is that misunderstanding, this kind of misunderstanding, which is unexpectedly and fortuitously useful for both of the empires, like it allows them both to be the winners because they don't know how the other side is keeping score. It may have simply ended because they started to understand one another better. Right. And the Arsacids who were going back and forth may have been one conduit of increased understanding. Over time, as interactions between the two empires became more frequent and more numerous, the Romans may have kind of caught on, hey, the Arsacids are telling themselves that we're becoming clients by virtue of hosting these children in Rome. The Parthians may have said, hey, the Romans are like trotting our princes out in these humiliating triumphal spectacles and thumping their chests and saying, we've beaten the Parthians. That's not the page that we're on at all. We need to rethink this arrangement. So pragmatic misunderstanding, this kind of useful misunderstanding, may simply have been a victim of its own success. And as the two empires interact more and more, as understanding takes over, the misunderstanding can no longer persist. That is very likely part of what happened. Another part of the answer is probably that the first ruling family of the Roman Empire, the Julio-Claudians, they famously end with Nero. Nero, you know, the emperor who's kind of infamous in our sources for his misconduct or for infuriating the Roman senatorial aristocracy. He is dethroned, and then the line of the Julio-Claudian emperors comes to an end. There's then a kind of brief civil war, and a new dynasty takes power. When you look at that from the Arsacid point of view, the Arsacids rule in Iran for 500 years or so. So they have this long tradition of totally unbroken dynastic continuity. They don't deal with states. They deal with dynasties. Like, that's the way that they see the world. And when the Julio-Claudian dynasty goes away, this kind of kinship networking mechanism that you've had with them, well, why do this again if it turns out that the ruling families over there are just going to be a dime a dozen and cycling in and out? What's the point of trying to do kinship networking if the kinship group that you're dealing with isn't going to be around for very long? So I think that's probably part of the reason as well. There may have been, you know, a host of other factors at play. For instance, in the second century CE, the Romans do invade the Parthian Empire. They're quite major invasions. They never stick. You know, that these territories are not permanently absorbed and governed by the Romans, but it's probably rather hard for a Parthian king to maintain at this time the impression that Parthia is dominating Rome when Parthia is on the back foot and really not in the driver's seat. And now has changed from, you know, in the late Republican period, as you were saying, Derek, they really kind of are the more aggressive power. They invade the Roman Empire. They intervene in the Roman civil wars. That's a regular feature of the late first century BCE. But then in the second century CE, Parthia is on the back foot a bit more. So probably difficult for the Parthian king to maintain at that point that we're the superior power, and maybe that contributed to it as well. So, you know, in sum, Danny, the answer to your question is a host of reasons. Some of them may be inherent to the arrangement itself, and some of them simply contingent accidents of history. Probably a number of things bring the arrangement down. And the Roman-Parthian relationship continues, but the Parthians don't keep sending their princes to the Roman court. That's pretty clear. To get to your second question there, the role of the Parthians in the Iranian national consciousness today, it's a difficult question. I should probably, you know, offer a caveat here that, you know, I'm no expert in modern Iranian history or the reception of ancient Iran among Iranian communities today, although I do make every effort to inform myself about these kinds of things. So my understanding is that in comparison with the Achaemenids, who are the first great empire of pre-Islamic Iran, and then the Sasanians, who are the last one before the Arab conquests of the 7th century.
And the Achaemenids, just to clarify, that's Cyrus, that's Darius, that's Xerxes, right?
Exactly.
That's Artaxerxes, right? So names that even some people listening to this podcast who might not know much about, you know, the Near East in antiquity or whatever it's termed now more properly. Apologies if Near East is probably from 1942. But yeah, those are the big names you might have heard of in relation to the Achaemenids, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And they have had a huge position in the Iranian national consciousness, you know, over the 20th century and still today. For all of these pre-Islamic dynasties, you know, that there's a bit of a tension because, of course, this is all pre-Islamic Iranian history. And when you have an Islamic theocracy in power, their relationship to these historical periods is going to be a bit ambivalent. There's also the complicating factor that Persepolis, which is the capital of the Achaemenid Empire, where Darius, for instance, the ruler who you just mentioned, Danny, where he presides and leaves behind, you know, incredible artistic installations, which are among, you know, the crown jewels of Iranian cultural heritage. You know, the Pahlavi dynasty leverage that site to great effect. I mean, it's hard to say, you know, to what extent ordinary Iranians actually appreciated this. Infamously, There is, you know, a huge kind of celebration of the Achaemenid Empire in the 70s. Foreign dignitaries are flown in from every country. There's this huge, lavish party, basically, at the site of Persepolis, which is extremely expensive and certainly did not help the economic malaise that Iran was going through in this period, and certainly didn't benefit the ordinary Iranian. So, then the revolution happens, and now you have an Islamic theocracy. Obviously, its relationship to that pre-Islamic past is going to be a little bit ambivalent. These days, however, I would say they have leaned in, at least as far as I can tell, they've leaned in a little more to celebrating these periods. The relief I mentioned before of Shapur I, the second Sasanian king, where he is on his horse triumphant and he has, you know, kowtowing emperors of Rome in front of him, that image has figured in Iranian propaganda quite prominently over the last year or so. And you've seen Netanyahu taking the place of those defeated Roman emperors. And more recently, you've seen Donald Trump taking the place of those defeated Roman emperors. So as far as I can see, the regime, you know, whether this is still an Islamic theocracy or now it's just the Revolutionary Guards, I'm not sure. I mean, we'll have to see how that shakes out and who exactly is in the driver's seat now that things have been shaken up. But in any event, whoever's in charge seems to be more willing to leverage the pre-Islamic Iranian past, which clearly maintains a fair amount of, it's got a lot of juice in the Iranian historical imagination. They seem to be more willing now to leverage that legacy, and it seems to be something we're seeing more and more.
Well, they're going to be sorry when Donald Trump's foster son Reza Pahlavi is.
That'd be so funny if they brought back a clientel fosterage with the Shah. Oh, that'd be so good. Bring it back. So ultimately, Jake, the upshot of the book is that we should bring back clientel fosterage through modern nation states. Well, we'll leave everyone with that message.
Well, I mean, I think the upshot is that we should bring it back for some people, and for other people, we should call it hostage taking, and then everybody can just kind of get what they want out of the relationship, and nobody has to be angry with each other.
Yeah, send Eric Trump to live in Iran.
Well, I mean, look, this background, the kinds of figures the book is about, this is not totally irrelevant to the case of Pahlavi. I mean, there was this New Yorker profile, I think it was late March it came out. It made the claim, never in Iran's 2,500-year history has an exiled prince invited foreign military intervention. That's not true.
That's not true. That's not true, New Yorker writer. Fact check. Three Pinocchios.
It's just not. I mean, Parthian and Sasanian history both contain counterexamples to this. You know, however, I have no idea to what extent we should be talking about the return of Pahlavi as like a serious outcome. It doesn't seem like
likely,
it will be at the moment. Yeah. But even if it did happen, I think the kinds of pressure that the returning Arsacids face when they, you know, re-enter Parthian territory, that would be a very, very real challenge if, right, you know, if we want to entertain this analogy at all. Somebody who lives away from their homeland for many, many years will have, an uphill battle to fight in terms of their legitimacy and the question of their alignment with the people of their homeland or the people that they've lived among for many years. So, the echo is there, I think.
That's a very good way to end. Jake, thank you so much. Everyone check out his book, link in the show notes, and we'd love to have you back again another time, my friend. Thank you.
Thanks so much. This was a blast.